It's now for a little homily that's going to end in song. Not me singing, all of us singing. So this is the time of year when I'm too busy to read novels for pleasure. So if I tell you I fell the past 2 weeks into reading two young adult fantasies, you won't be surprised that I had to ask myself, why am I doing this? I mean, there's a thousand things I should be doing. Why am I doing this? Why am I reading these fantasies? Two novels, one author, an elderly Englishman named Philip Pullman. Michelle introduced me to him nearly 20 years ago as the author of the fantasy trilogy called His Dark Materials. You might have noticed that that has been adapted to an HBO series that is currently airing. Now, Pullman is fascinated. He's absolutely fascinated with the sinister side of religion. His Dark Materials chronicles a rebellion against the magisterium, a global church that has a dark view of human nature. The magisterium claims to represent God on earth, and eventually in this trilogy, we do meet the God in heaven, and Pullman presents him as old and very senile. Now, the leader of the rebellion has visions of deposing God and establishing a republic of heaven. And this struggle unfolds in a destabilized universe where there are countless parallel worlds that have begun leaking into each other in dangerous ways. The central hero of His Dark Materials is Lyra, a 12-year-old girl fathered out of wedlock by the leader of the rebels during his affair with a ruthless magisterium official. But when we meet Lyra in the first book, this teenager, even younger than Mary when she bore Jesus, is the ward of a college at Oxford University, and she has no knowledge of her parentage. I don't want to spoil this for anyone who wants to go ahead and read the trilogy, but it develops into a wonderful twist on the Adam and Eve story with a positive view of human sexuality when grounded in love. All of this plays out in a plot filled with fantastical figures and inventions, including a globe-spanning clan of witches, humongous polar bears with human-like intelligence and language, a marginalized gypsy-inspired branch of humanity that Pullman clearly admires. He also relies heavily on the concept of talking animals called demons that act as the visible individual souls in Lyra's world and in some of the parallel worlds, but not all of them. Demons frequently switch their animal nature, a butterfly one minute, a dog the next, a lynx the next, when you're a child. But once you pass through puberty, your daemon gets fixed on a particular animal. When Michelle read His Dark Materials many years ago as a literacy specialist, she told me, "Barnaby, you have to read this. This is the ultimate Unitarian fantasy." So I got trapped this month in Pullman's latest project. It's a new trilogy expanding on the storyline of His Dark Materials. And the first book in the new trilogy revolves around the infant Lyra's brushes with death. There's sort of a distant echo of the perils that the baby Jesus faces with King Herod in the Bible stories. And it tells how she ends up tucked away at Oxford in the years leading up to the first book in the Dark Materials trilogy. The second book in the new trilogy, called The Secret Commonwealth, jumps right over his dark materials into Lyra's adulthood. It was published this fall. Michelle spotted it at the Ilsley Library, brought it home, and I snatched it away from her, and I reached the cliff-hanging ending on page 633 this past Sunday. So it's going to be hard waiting for the final book of that trilogy to be written. And I know all of us are waiting for things that are more important, and they're also harder. And so I don't want to make too big a deal out of my impatience. But it occurred to me this week that I should ponder whether this reading is sheer escapism or some part of answering my call to serve you. I concluded, as you'll see, that there were, in fact, a few messages that I think are worth sharing from the pulpit. I won't blame you, though, when you come to me at coffee hour if your feedback is, "I forgive you, but don't ever subject us to the same cover-up for your weakness in the face of temptation when the third book comes out. For what it's worth, here's what I found looking for links between my seemingly escapist reading and our theme for the month, the UU Third Principle, affirming acceptance of one another and promising to encourage growth in our congregation's spiritual growth. The key is another Pullman invention that I haven't mentioned yet, the alethiometer. This, we are told, is a handheld metal device for truth seekers. Six of them were made in the 17th century before the lone craftsman who invented them was burned at the stake by the magisterium for heresy. They are highly prized and their locations are closely guarded secrets. Lyra, of course, has one. Alethiometers have three hands. When the device is properly manipulated, they spin until they point at various symbols that are painted around the edge of the alethiometer. And the resting point provides a truthful answer to whatever question the operator is posing. So you can think of it as a device to pierce mystery. Alas, each of the symbols pinned around the rim, has hundreds of layers of meaning that they shift depending on where all the different hands are pointing. And very, very few people have ever mastered the alethiometer, and those who have to resort to libraries full of interpretive books to figure out what they're reading. Except Lyra. Her unique gifts as a 12-year-old include the rapidly increasing capacity that's born of a lot of practice to sort of intuitively read the alethiometer quickly without recourse to any of the books. Now we skip to the 21-year-old Lyra in the book that I just finished, which is called The Secret Commonwealth. She's losing her grip on the ways of the alethiometer. She's become infatuated as a university student with a best-selling novel and a philosophy text. And each of these two books, in their own way, argues that there is no such thing as truth beyond what is physically present in front of you. And they suggest that even that truth is ultimately pointless. Her attraction to this brutal form of realism has caused a rift with her daemon. Panteleimon, who settled when she reached puberty into the shape of a smart, alert, fierce when he needs to be, weasel-like pine marten, Pan, as she calls him, is accusing her of losing her imagination. Eventually, the tensions between Lyra and Pan reach the point where they can't bear it, and Pan takes off to try and find Lyra's imagination out there in the wild world. Now, even brief separations from humans and daemons are excruciating for both of them. You are, in effect, losing connection with your animal spirit. Other humans are hostile when they find someone missing their daemon. It's a huge disability, and it often leads to fatal depression or mishaps. The 21-year-old Lyra, minus Pan, is in short a stubborn, brave, young adult mess. The secret commonwealth of the title refers to the largely hidden, mysterious forces of the world that make it so hard to pin truth down, even with an alethiometer. Generally, Pullman suggests, these pagan forces manifest as creatures, extreme weather, other phenomena that are variations on what we assume to be true and plausible. As such, they usually pop up in the story in opposition to some tyrannical oppression of the magisterium. They're sort of aligned with the good guys almost all the time, but because they're mysterious forces of the world, they're sometimes in conflict with each other as well. Over and over, conflict with these fantastical elements of the commonwealth teach Lyra things she has to accept via faith and intuition about herself and others. It's not so much a story of spiritual growth in her case, but spiritual renewal, bit by bit, with many setbacks. Understanding comes, if ever, after the facts. And that, in many ways, is the story of so much of what we celebrate in December. Our lives are a voyage into acceptance of events and each other, a voyage in which we repeatedly bump up against incomplete truths. Steve talked very vividly about how they can be manifest with his particular visual impairment, but we all have the incomplete truths that we bump up against. And more is unfolding than we can fully grasp. In the Hanukkah holiday, Jews have celebrated that focusing on a miracle story added on to the memories of a historic revolt against long odds that drove foreign rulers out of Jerusalem. The real story ended badly. The fundamentalist Jewish tribe that led the revolt turned out to be prone to its own abuses of power, and their steady, relentless inhumanity paved the way for Rome to become the new foreign rulers of Judea. But the miracle story of the revolt leader's initial act in power, relighting the candles in Jerusalem's temple, and the candles that burned for 8 days when the oil supply looked to be only enough for one, that miracle story that was bolted onto the history outlived their actual sins. Today, it is the centerpiece of a collection of family-based rituals, gift-giving, and games that celebrate the liberating power of faith, courage, and love of freedom in the darkest of times. Who keeps it alive? Not the scientists. Maybe it's best understood as an emotional piece of us in tune with what Pullman describes as a secret commonwealth. Similarly, we look back and wonder today at what our forebears knew and didn't know about the winter solstice. They realized that the days had becoming shorter and shorter since early summer, and suddenly they begin to lengthen again. But how challenging it must have been, how scary it must have been to struggle with the experience that the days were lengthening, but winter was deepening and was going to get worse for several weeks more, worse and more dangerous. So how reassuring it must have been to know that Earth and the heavens had provided evidence that this danger would eventually pass into a new spring. Pullman's vision of the secret commonwealth is deeply rooted in mystery that they must have encountered fearfully. No wonder the solstice rituals in which they sought roles for themselves so often represented non-human forces in song and dance and costumes. It happens also in the Christmas story. I won't go into the way the secret commonwealth gets imposed on that with talking animals and Santa Claus in addition to the new Bible stories, but it happens there. In the service of telling more insistently the truth, the emotional truth of this dark time of year, we engage in these kinds of stories. And in that spirit, I want to invite you to sing along with the greatest solstice song I know. It's a song in which the stories of our forebearers imposed many centuries ago on the constellations of stars above us blend into our winter story today. It's The Turning of the Year by Anne Hills. Shannon's going to start playing it. I invite you to sing along with the lyrics if you like. They're printed in your order of service. I'm sure you'll pick up the chorus as we go along. So, at the turning of the year, Shannon.